From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
Our first guest this morning is Daniel Levitin, who has written a book called Successful Aging: A Neuroscientist Explores the Power and Potential of Our Lives. We will be speaking with Daniel about a number of subjects, including the role that mindset and personality play in aging with grace and confidence, the myth of failing memory, the fact that depression is not more common in later life than at younger ages, the importance of circadian rhythms. Daniel Levitin, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me back, Lynn, my second home.
That's right. Your sister lives in Park City. And so you must be here quite often.
Yeah. And now my dear friend, Tom Brosseau, one of the most amazing people, guitarists, songwriters, lives in Salt Lake City, and he hosts his own NPR affiliate radio show now.
Oh, how about that?
The Great American Folk Show.
Oh, good. We will have to tune into that. We really have an amazing collection of people in this area. So, Daniel, I wanted to ask
I always lower the collective IQ when I walk into Park City. But
oh, I highly doubt
people
that.
Teach me things.
I highly doubt that. So let's start here. You talk about a couple of really important personality traits that...
I think that we...
And those are conscientiousness and openness to experience. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, so we tend not to think of personality having much to do with how you age. I mean, at least the old story was... You know, the reason I wrote the book is there's a lot of news here, a lot of scientific news about how things work. And what many of us were taught and led to believe for decades was that, well, you have a genetic propensity towards certain diseases, and maybe if you've got a bad diet and you don't exercise, you're going to be a goner. But it turns out that personality plays a big role in this. And two personality traits in particular. One of them is conscientiousness, and the other is curiosity. And we can drill down. Each of these is a stand-in, a proxy for a whole bunch of things. For example, conscientiousness has to do with stick-to-itiveness and reliability, dependability, following instructions. It involves moral and ethical behavior and a whole cluster of things that more than any other factor in your life, you know, unless you get hit by a bus or something when you're younger, that predicts how well you're going to do at every phase of life, during your childhood, your teenage years, adulthood, and on into older ages.
Daniel, I'm wondering, though, you know, this openness to experience, it's quite ubiquitous, I would say, that as we get older, we get less and less open to experience, especially new experiences. And we probably see that across the board, and it's really difficult to break ourselves free from that, isn't it?
Very much so, Lynn. So we now understand there's a neurochemical basis for this. When you're young, your brain produces in high amounts neurochemical rewards for you to learn things and discover new things. Human beings have the longest period of being raised by their parents, proportional to their lifespan, of any other organism we know of. So unlike a bird or a, who's got hardwired instructions about how to make the nest, the mama bird isn't teaching it, or the spider who's got genetic code to make the web, we don't have these kinds of things. We have to learn them. And our reward as kids for learning typically isn't the learning itself, though that comes later. It's this little blast of neurochemicals, including dopamine, that signal pleasure in learning something. Those chemicals start to deplete with every decade after 20. And by the time we're 60, most of us are less interested in learning new things. I mean, not you and John. You do this, you learn new things for a living, and you're far from 60, but you get my drift. The point, though, is that, as you say, although it's a tendency, a neurochemical tendency, to want to settle in and not do new things, we have to push against it. We have to make an effort, because that openness to new experience, what I called curiosity a moment ago, and it related, of course, that's what keeps you from having your brain atrophy. It's what allows you to grow new pathways on into your 90s and 100s. And those turn out, Lynn, to be neuroprotective.
That's fascinating. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Daniel Levitin, who has written Successful Aging, a neuroscientist explores the power and the potential of our lives. Now, Daniel was on the program 5 years ago. He joined us to talk about A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. I mention this because our listeners may want to check out the podcast or the book, which is certainly relevant in today's world. Daniel, I know that you have spoken and met with the Dalai Lama, and that must have been a fascinating conversation. The one takeaway I have on the Dalai, well, I have a couple, but one of them is during his 5-day birthday party with Desmond Tutu, somebody chronicled all of their meetings over this 5-day period when Dalai Lama turned 80, and what he said was, emotions are sometimes hard to change, but perspective is really easy to change. What do you think about that?
Well, this is what he's been teaching his whole life, and he's not just a teacher, he emulates it. I think that so many of us are inspired by him because he walks the walk that he talks. It was fascinating to spend time with him and get his insights about aging. And yeah, I think the distinction that he makes, he studies neuroscience very closely, and he sent a number of his monks to neuroscience colleagues of mine for brain scans. The distinction that His Holiness makes is that emotions are things that happen to you that are ideally something you can channel or guide or control, but they come from your body. And your perspective on things, the way that you react, is under your control. So, you know, there was an old saying that came out of the hippies' 60s that really traces its origins back to the Buddha, which is that you can't control what life throws at you, but you can control how you respond to it. And that's exactly what he believes can be achieved through meditation, but different people achieve it in different ways. We achieve it through therapy or through being inspired by role models or through the arts or by sheer force of will. Some of us acquire that ability to change our mindset through the right drug therapy. You know, you see a psychiatrist, you're depressed, you get antidepressants, and you can change yourself. You can change your perspective.
And our humanness requires us to connect with other people, and I can't think of any example which illustrates this more than something that I read in an interview of yours about a friend of yours, Peter Hingelman, who you were playing music with, and you ended up taking the subway home where you encountered somebody. Can you tell that story?
Oh, man, John, you really did your research. Peter Hingelman is a wonderful musician who had a series of albums out on Columbia Records, songwriter. Also happens to be a practicing Orthodox Jew. And we had a gig together and in New York City, and we were going the same direction after, and we took the subway home, and he had his guitar in his hand. And he like the Dalai Lama, tries to change his perspective in every moment with every encounter, and to practice the compassionate ideals of Judaism. You remember Jesus's Sermon on the Mount was basically a Jewish teaching. I mean, Jesus was a Jewish rabbi, and the teaching that do unto others is very much in Peter's mind all the time. So we encountered this evidently homeless fellow who was wearing soiled clothing and probably hadn't, from the smell, hadn't taken a bath in some weeks and had peed himself and was really not doing well. And normally in a situation like that, it's 10:30 at night in New York City, in Brooklyn. And, you know, you would walk away from someone like this because you don't know what's going to happen. And you don't want to deal with it. But Peter actually walked toward him and engaged him in a conversation. And the guy asked for some help. And Peter opened his wallet and gave him some money. And then Peter pulled out Peter pointed to his guitar. He says, "Do you mind if I play a song for you?" And the guy seemed just completely taken aback, but he didn't stop Peter. So Peter took out his guitar and he wrote a song on the spot. It's a song I'd never heard before, and it used the man's name in the song. And it came around to a chorus of saying, "I can see that you're a man with dignity. I can see that you're a human being. And that, you know, other people don't see it." And this man, more than the money, this human contact meant so much to him, he just started crying. And then, of course, we all started crying. It was the most powerful example of human connection that I'd ever seen. And in the most unlikely of circumstances. And, you know, we who have the privilege of being able to sit in our homes or cars and listen to NPR radio often talk a good game about how we want to be charitable. But when push comes to shove, we become like that old adage, "I love mankind, it's people I can't stand." And we avoid the intimate contact that Peter embraced.
Peter said something very profound in the interview that I reviewed, and that was that the homeless man was trying to speak, but he couldn't get words out. It was inaudible. And Peter said, I can't hear you, but I can feel you."
That's exactly right. It was powerful. And Peter really is that. I mean, there were no cameras around. He was not putting on a show. Peter Himmelman.
What a nice story that is. Daniel, most of us would say that we've aged, 10 or so years in the last 11 months since COVID has separated us from people and introduced this underlying stress that we all feel, even if we can't really put it into words exactly why we're stressed. Some others have experienced stress that's more overt, like losing jobs and homes and loved ones. But I have to think that somewhere along the line, we don't have to age during times like these in our lives, if we sort of do the right thing, and if we are disciplined in continuing to have meaningful contact and exercise and all of the things that contribute to successful aging overall. What would you say about that?
Oh, it's really interesting you say that, Lynn. I wrote an op-ed just about that for the New York Times, and I'm waiting to hear back from them about whether they'll take it. You're exactly on point in terms of the way I think. The times like these, extraordinary times, require us to really double down on our efforts to stay focused and keep our eye on the ball. And when the lockdown first started in March of last year, and none of us really knew how long it was going to last, people were saying 8 or 10 weeks, maybe 3 months. But my virologist friends were telling me, "Oh, no, we're, you know, we're going to be in this same place a year from now. And I would tell that to my friends, and they'd say, you're crazy. But I started saying to my friends, okay, well, just pretend. Pretend that there's going to be a year where your life is completely topsy-turvy. And at the end of that year, do you want to look back on it and say, I don't know what happened. I gained 10 pounds, and I lost touch with everybody that was meaningful. I didn't get anything done. Or do you want to actually plan for how you're going to spend the time? And all of the things that contribute to successful aging in terms of healthy practices, following a good diet, getting exercise, making time to reflect and take a different perspective, as John and you and I were talking about with His Holiness. Movement more than exercise, really, getting around and moving. And then experiencing openness, taking on some new thing. What will I do during this pandemic period that I've never done before? It's crucial that we have goals, that we set them for ourselves. I look at it this way. Park City is a town that has many interns in it, as I know. They come there for the film festival or for the institute, many of them are young and just getting started in their first jobs. And the story I tell myself is, imagine I've got an 18-year-old intern coming to work for me for the summer, and I've got work laid out. I know what I want him or her to do over the next 3 months. We talked about it in the interview. I hire the person, I sit them down on June 1st, and I tell them, this is what you're going to do. I don't just leave them alone and come back 3 months later. That would be crazy. They probably are not capable of doing 3 months of work without any guidance. Instead, I break it into little pieces. I say, this is what you're going to do this week. This is what you're going to do today. Why don't you start here? I'll come back and check on you in a couple of hours. And the point of the story is, all of us are that 18-year-old intern now. We have to check on ourselves. We have to set some explicit goals. And my wife got me a Fitbit for my birthday. It reminds me every 50 minutes I have to get up and walk around and not just sit there. And I have to make my 10,000 steps in a day. We don't know about the science behind that. It's somewhat arbitrary, but it's a goal. And in addition to all of that, I decided I was going to learn to play the ukulele.
That is so great. I know here our ukulele classes are always full. You cannot get into them. And so there must be a lot of people taking up these things. I wanted to ask you a question about openness. And I'll relay a little story that happened to me. It was a couple of weeks ago, and we had been taking some additional cautionary measures because there was, some question of exposure to COVID. And so I was really, really isolating, not going anywhere, not talking to anyone except for on Zoom calls and things like that. And then after a period of a couple of weeks, I found myself at White Pine Touring, which is, where the cross-country skiing is at the golf course in Park City. And I started talking with one of the employees there who I had never met before. And suddenly we were in this conversation that was just filling me up, that made me feel so alive and so, just so connected. And I was marveling at my own self during that. And then afterwards I thought, what if that person had not been open to this kind of contact and conversation and connection? And so it tells me something about how we all need to be open to that. If someone, approaches us and needs to talk, well, maybe they've been isolating for the last 2 weeks and we should really try to make that connection.
Yeah, take a different perspective. This is not somebody who's bothering me or interfering with my schedule. It's somebody who's trying to make a connection, and maybe I can make it back. The nice thing about smallish towns like Park City is that you can't really be an ash there, because you are going to run into the people again. You have to kind of be nice and honest for the most part, compared to a big city like New York or Los Angeles that runs on people figuring they'll never encounter you again. And that openness, I think, is just a reflection of a deeper issue psychologically, which is that we are a human species, and we evolved over tens of thousands of years in tight groups and with daily contact. We didn't evolve to be hermits sitting alone in a corner in our iPods or earpods or sitting at a computer. We evolved to tell stories and interact with each other in person. And while Zoom is better than nothing at all, or calls like this, this is the high point of my week. it really is, having a conversation with you two. I wish it was in person.
Yeah.
It's better than nothing. But, you know, occasionally those in-person conversations are wholly different. Our brain responds differently. Our body responds differently. It's not just the three-dimensionality of it. It's the immediacy of it. We have, my wife and I are in a small neighborhood of Los Angeles where we know everybody, and we walk the dog a couple of times a day. And we'll stop and see neighbors that just during the lockdown we've become friendly with, and we'll chat for 5 minutes. And it's very, it sounds trite perhaps, but it's very meaningful, even if we're just talking about the weather or about nothing in particular. I'll give you one example. There's a little 8-year-old in the neighborhood named Jasper, a little girl, and she wrote, as part of a class project, they wrote letters to the President of the United States. And her mom had posted it on social media, and we saw it. And so we saw them on the street the other day, and we said to the parents and the older sister, "So are you getting ready to look for a place in Washington, D.C., you know, for when Jasper's president?" She's 8 now, but she had said in her letter she wants to be president. It was a silly little conversation, but we were all open to it. We had a good time, and these little moments stitched together make up a year.
Well, that's fascinating. Hey, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, thanks for joining us. We're talking to Daniel Levitin. He's written Successful Aging, A Neuroscientist Explores the Power and the Potential of Our Lives. I am intrigued by this whole connectedness thing. And our humanness, I think a lot of us, when we think about connecting, we think about maybe our parents, our children, our friends. I want to make sure I get out and see my friends, you know, those sorts of things. But in what you were just talking about with Lynn and with myself, about some of these, what you call micro contacts, micro connections, if you're standing in line at a supermarket and you talk to the person behind us, behind you, there's value in that, isn't it? Isn't there?
This was one of the most surprising things that came out of my research for the book. I mean, by the way, I just to give some context here, I thought I would write the book in 2 years. It took me 4. There were thousands of papers I needed to read, and they kept coming out as I was writing the book, and I kept having to add them. I read about 4,000 papers, and all of them are in the back of the book for anybody who wants to follow up. This is not just some guy talking. This is
a
neuroscientist.
Project.
Yeah, and there were a number of surprises, even though I'm in the field, as it were, things that I didn't know or that had just newly been discovered. And this is one of the most fascinating. Quality of life across socioeconomic class, across the age span in many different countries is greatly enhanced by what, as you say, are micro contacts. Just standing in line at the supermarket, going for a walk, and talking to somebody for a minute, you'd think, well, that's not very deep. But again, we're a social species. We're basically primates, apes. We don't literally get close and pick nits off one another and groom one another, but we have social grooming. And when you ask people how they feel about their neighborhood, if they know their neighbors, even if they don't talk to them much, but if they talk to them now and then, they report being much happier with the neighborhood. There is a sort of American ideal that if you get rich enough, you can sequester yourself and put yourself in a house with an electric gate and a big hedge and not have to see anybody. And when I drive through neighborhoods like Bel Air, California, you never see anybody walking on the street. Brentwood, Beverly Hills, you just wouldn't do that. Where we live in the neighborhood of Los Feliz, everybody's walking and talking. We have a neighborhood market. I know the grocer. Every time I go in, we chat for a little bit. I had no idea, personally, how much it would mean to have these little micro contacts in my life. It makes me feel part of the community, and it turns out that's important.
Absolutely. Daniel, can you take a minute and talk about forgetfulness and the stories we tell each other from the perspective of a 20-year-old and from the perspective of a 70-year-old?
So one of the many myths that I hope to explode with conversations like this and with the book is that old age is necessarily always accompanied by a decline in memory. It isn't necessarily. We portray older adults as being doddering and having bad memories, portray them that way in film and television and books. But the reality is that that's not the case. The research comparison might be to look at 20-year-olds, as we often do in university laboratories. So if a 70-year-old loses their car keys or their cell phone or forgets their computer password, they're likely to do a head slap and say, man, I am on the brink of Alzheimer's. This is the end. I can't believe I lost my cell phone or my keys. 20-year-olds are doing that all the time. I can tell you this. I'm a college professor. I see a new crop of them. They lose their keys, their dorm room keys. They lose their cell phones. They leave them in class. They forget their passwords.
But they tell different stories.
Yeah. When it happens to a 20-year-old, they say, oh, I got too much on my plate. I didn't get enough sleep last night. I had too much to drink. They don't say they've got Alzheimer's. It's the same behavior, as you point out, John, but different stories. And this has been confirmed in the laboratory. You bring 70-year-olds, 80-year-olds into the laboratory in a situation where they're not stressed out by it, as laboratories can be. You make the laboratory environment less stressful, they perform just like their 20-year-old counterparts.
I love to hear that. My 81-year-old mother is actually standing by listening to this interview. And, you know, she has a great memory, but I find her, as a lot of elderly people do, they feel like they have to defend themselves once they, you know, forget where they put their car keys so that people won't think that they have dementia. And you know, it's actually, though, it's probably good for her that she has to defend herself, because it probably keeps her memory really vibrant and active. And she probably tries that much harder to think about where she puts her keys. Whereas I, as a very young thing, never know where I put my keys, right?
Well, yeah, there's a couple of things about this. One is that, yes, I don't want to paint the wrong gloss on this. With every decade after 40, our brains slow down a bit. Now, a number of compensatory mechanisms kick in. We're better at making decisions. We're better at pattern matching and figuring things out because of experience. But we do slow down with every decade after 40. And when you're 81, it can take longer to retrieve a memory or a word or a name, but you eventually get it, which means your memory's not impaired. It just means it's slowed down. And the other thing is, I would say if you forget where you put your keys, that doesn't mean Alzheimer's, but if you're looking at them and you can't remember what they're for, that might be time to call the doctor.
Oh, yes, so true. I mean, I chuckle with that, but it is, you know, that's a really valid point that you make. Daniel, we've got just about a minute or so left, but I wanted to ask you about the hippocampus in the brain and how it evolves for things like geo-navigation, which I always think it's really important to turn off your car GPS and let and try to maintain that sense of direction. I know that's got to be good for your brain. And many people now say that they couldn't get anywhere without the navigation on their car. What do you think about that? And how often should we just really try to find our own way down the block?
Well, so we, if those of you remember your introductory neuroscience class, you remember that the hippocampus is the seat of human memory. We think of it as storing phone numbers and lyrics to songs and names of your friends and dates. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. But in fact, the hippocampus evolved over tens of thousands of years in humans and primates and other species as a geo-navigation tool to keep track of where you were, where the water was, where the food was. And now if we don't allow it to serve that function, it can atrophy. So it's a good idea to go for walks and whenever you can, especially in nature and on new trails if you can. And ideally, you would be able to navigate a city without GPS. Of course, if you're in a hurry, you want it to show you the fastest route, but sometimes it's only shaving 30 or 40 seconds off the route, and who cares? Turn it off and make your way, and if you get lost or completely messed up, turn it on again. But yeah, it's neuroprotective and helpful to let your hippocampus do its thing.
You know, Daniel, the next time you're in Park City, I think the three of us need to get together.
Absolutely.
We should go out and have lunch. We have a lot to talk about.
And we should go for a hike.
And we should go for a hike as well. But this has been a fascinating conversation. And once again, I also want to just shine a light on a book called A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age, which we spoke to you about in 2015. It's certainly relevant today.
Thank you very much.
The book is Successful Aging, A Neuroscientist Explores the Power and Potential of Our Lives. Daniel Levitin, thanks so much for joining us again on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.